First up, though, this hour, as always, on Tuesday, writer Colin Fleming joins us. You can get your hands on his brand new book right now. It's part of the 33 and a third series. It's called Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. And Colin Fleming joins us. Hello there, Colin.
Yo, Sepritchka.
Hey, where can I get my hands on a hallway Hermie? He looks pretty intimidating.
Doesn't he? When he's crouching low behind the ball cap, you're less than awesome in the field, Red Sox. Hallway Hermie doing his thing. He will pop out, and he has been known to cut some people. I found him, well, as you know, people maybe, they join in medias ras, Kimball. They're not there for the entire thing. So I found Hallway Hermie one day outside when I was walking. Someone had put him out in the recyclables. He said, "I am a fellow who endures, and I recognize you as one too." I said, "Yes, Hallway Hermie, I'll put you in my pocket, but first we have to run some stairs before we go back." So we did that together.
Yeah, but he had the easy part. He was just coming along for the ride.
And as a gay icon, Hallway Hermie, Hermie himself, I think he appreciated how willing I was for us just to be proximate from the jump.
There you go. I like that. It's good to have a pal, and he's coming through for you. We're going to talk some horror this week, a lot of different types of horror here. And let's begin with a wonderful work of yours that's in the newest Portland Monthly, The Captain's Walk. It's a ghost story and then some.
And it's also not a ghost story.
Right.
So it's a whole bunch of different things at once. It'll be part of a book of mine called The Ghost Drew Legs. That's the main title. The subtitle is Stories of the Dead for the More or Less Living. Because as we talked about recently, I think one of the huge issues with ghost stories, where they fail, is they lack utility. They have a purpose. It's a very clear-cut purpose, but it's a limited purpose. And that's to play your spine, like a zither, as we were talking about. They create an atmosphere, and at the end, they can be a little bulky, and they don't end smoothly. They have to be explained away or theorized away. But the ghost story is almost always about the atmosphere, the mood, giving you some fears on a winter's night when you're reading, or an early autumn night like this one, close enough. And that's not what I do at all with my ghost stories. They're really a genre unto themselves. Like one we had discussed one time was Post Fletcher, which was about that guy who had a ghost, even though he himself wasn't dead. So that'll be in this book. And this story takes the form of a man and a woman, and they have this old house. It's from 1721, I believe. And they depart from their marriage bed each like Saturday morning, where they sleep 3 feet apart, because we know there's been some problem in this marriage. And there are these what appear to be watery footprints in this house that they decide used to belong to this old sea cabin. And they could be explained away, these footprints, through whatever theory or whatnot, some scientific explanation. But at the same time, they have this supernatural agency, but that agency is commenting on the very real issues between these two people.
And the captain, real or not, plays a role in, well, in all aspects, including the dissolution of their marriage.
So they create this legend of this captain, and he was at sea, and he returned home from sea, and he found his wife in the arms of another man. And the language becomes, when they're talking about this invented character, it becomes plummy. It becomes the way we get when we get caught up in the telling of a tale. We fall into that sort of like that vein of Argo, and they both do that, but they're at the same time, they're commenting on their own union, and as you mentioned, the dissolution of that union, because she has done something that's going to parallel that scene with the captain, and this is sort of their way of talking about not just what happened, but the inevitable parting, because they're not going to be together much longer. They have what they call this breakfast march, where it's not even like formally called that between the two of them, but it's the way they walk down the narrow hallway together, like in some narrow main house from a couple centuries ago, where they can't even walk side by side. So all of the details, as we've talked about before, every single last detail in the story has to back and has to tell. So you're getting all of that accumulation in the story that's 1,100 words or whatever it is. But as it's 1,100 words, it contains these universe. It contains this entire present state of a marriage, a past state of a marriage. It suggests the future of these two people, and it comes in-house in a ghost story that's also not a ghost story. So it has legs because it's really about these people. It's not just about like, oh, this is spooky, although it's also that too. But then it's also emotionally spooky, emotionally macabre, and gutting, really, for how these two lives can play out going forward.
And it's another story that speaks of the ghosts that we all have, that follow us wherever we go, from relationships, previous encounters along the way, and how real they are to us tells us a lot about ourselves.
I feel like in a number of my stories, I redefine, or maybe pull into light, underscore, what it means for something to be a ghost. A ghost is not like necessarily the billowing shadow form with the eyes, the holes in the sheet or whatnot that we see on Halloween. The ghost is something that is how we self-haunt quite often. Because like you'll see in ghost stories, like one of the rules is that a ghost can't actually haunt you or can't hurt you, can't do anything to you, can just kind of float up. But my ghost, because they're the ghosts of humanists, they don't really work that way. So they also have kind of cutting agency to do real harm. There has been a rending in the fabric of these lives and this story. And so the ghost becomes almost a stand-in for the real haunting. And I think that's when the whole idea of a ghost having legs, that's what I mean by that, that you just have the moment, you have the 25 minutes it takes to read something, and that's usually the end of the ghost. But with a story like this, or post-Fletcher, or any of them in this book, some of the ones I've sent you lately, the ghost, it has these legs that goes out into the world. And that's really just something no one's ever done before. You'd think someone would have hit upon this in ghost stories, but it was always like, oh, the form's limited, I'm going to be limited. And I thought, no, you can make this as expansive as the cosmos. So that was sort of my thinking.
Well, I look forward to the book, but for right now, check out The Captain's Walk in the newest edition of Portland Monthly. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. A couple of great old-time radio classic ghost tales, and I have to tell you, I had never listened before to The Weird Circle, and I love their production of Poe's Telltale Heart.
The Weird Circle was only around for a couple years, 3 years actually, in the mid-1940s, so this is right in the middle of that run, and it seemed like there were a lot of shows of the Eldridge variety, and they all had a kind of like stamp, how they were going to be introduced, their sort of audiophonic mise-en-scene, and so this one starts with like a hermit. He's in a cave by the sea, and he like intones, "It's about to get weird," is how you could translate what those aren't the exact words, but words to that effect. And so the story of Poe's Telltale Heart. And Poe, it's funny because Poe's work had a lot of legs in a way because he was the first to do a number of different things. But his actual stories are usually pretty circumscribed. They're bare on plot. Not a lot happens in them. You can really reduce them to like one sentence. Guy kills somebody, thinks he hears a heart beating under the floorboard, gives himself up. It's like very much a Raskolnikov sort of deal in many. So this is updated to this guy with his uncle, and he lives with his uncle, is sort of like infirm but not quite infirm uncle, and they have these dinner guests that just show up like abruptly, and there's some business about a knife that's hanging on the wall, and if it's hanging crookedly, that means someone in the family is going to die. And what's notable about the episode is you have this Greek chorus effect of these voices piped in, these different layers of sound. And they end up providing like commentary. There is conscience. They're goading him on. But then as we get further into the program, he enters into dialogue with them. So it's like a subtle sort of clever shift that can be missed upon like a first listen. But that was the kind of sophistication that you could get even in the 1940s with radio of this nature.
And very effective. Not a lot of overwhelming, so much that you notice them, sound effects, but those they use worked very well.
What you want to do, and you'll notice this now, is you like cast back through your memory. The things that are scariest are not overt. They're not right. like monsters rising out of the... It's something that's a little tiny bit off. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's like, I noticed that hanging there before. It's just something askew in the space-time continuum of our expected status quo. That's when things get really messed up and do you in. Because there's a reason for that. It's the same as like the heart. The heart skips a beat. There's something wrong with the rhythm. It's always just like something slightly off that does us in, that does a marriage, and that doesn't it snowballs, but there's always like that one sort of discordant note where you go, uh-oh. I mean, we see it sort of writ large in film noir. There's always that moment in the best film noirs where the character who's screwed has to make a decision one way or the other, and it's going to impact his entire life. And so that decision snowballs into everything else. You can pinpoint it all out of the past, whatever it is. So they're actually quite similar to ghost stories in that way, because they're getting into the marrow of the human existence. So that's why I love a ghost story that is chilling in the atmosphere. We've talked a lot about M.R. James, but you want something that isn't so circumscribed. You want something more expansive.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. I also enjoy the heck out of Northwest University production, what they called their Living Fiction series, their version of The Devil and Daniel Webster.
I thought you'd like that because it's in the spirit of some of the productions you've mounted, right?
Where
it's very much a volunteer effort, and it's remarkable that something like this still exists. So really, it's just like the drama club kind of out of Northwestern put this together, this radio play, and it was in essence distributed by NBC, so people heard it. But you wouldn't think something like that survives from however many decades ago it was. And The Devil and Daniel Webster is a riff on the classic Faust legend, same as Robert Johnson at The Crossroads, right? It all goes back to Faust. You can see it in like an episode of Twilight, well, a few episodes of The Twilight Zone, where someone is sitting there so down on their luck and they're like, oh, this sucks. I don't want to do this anymore. I would sell my soul to have this other thing work out the way I wanted to. It's like paging Dr. Beelzebub, and like the devil shows up and says, hey, what was that you were saying? I can give you some great stuff, and a bunch of college girls too. So that happens in here. You have to listen carefully, but I heard it. And so this is a classic tale of old New England, Americana. This is around the time of the Revolutionary War. So you have like Washington Irving and Headless Horseman. This is like around that same sort of miasmic pocket of our folkloric horror. And I'd say it's better than serviceable. It holds up pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great little story. It's an awesome film. I mean, really, the best version of this is the film, which you can get in the Criterion Collection. But, I thought you would dig that.
Now, speaking of the Criterion Collection, apparently I have to get a membership. I could not watch Phantom of the Monastery, the film from 1934. So, fill me in.
So, I'm going to have to carry us. That's how it's going to be.
It is, yes. But you can do it. You're up to the task. Think of me as just another Hermie in your pocket.
I always do, my friend. I always do. One in the front, one in the back.
Thank you.
I thought a guy like you would show some industriousness and maybe a little OKRU. I didn't realize that I had to that we were Criterion dependent. I'll make note going forward to make sure that I get you.
Well, I should get a membership because it's got awesome stuff.
No, they screwed me pretty hard with work. So you not getting a member, like I'm certainly not going to be like, you should definitely get that because they're a pretty horrible group of people in my considerable experience trying to deal with them. But the only version you could have found out there, I'm pretty sure it would have been in Spanish. This is a Mexican film from 1934. And there is a woman and two guys, and I don't know what they're doing, like wandering around by like the Arroyo and they are lost at night and it's getting cold. And it's notable because this one guy has this kind of like modern looking jacket. I think that's a crucial point of this story because it roots it in what was the then modern world. And someone comes upon them with a dog. He's this shady monk type character. He's like, oh, you can take shelter up here at the convent. And they go into the convent and there's a love triangle happening of sorts because the man and a woman are married, but she is thirsty for this other guy who's not quite like responding to her advances, but he's also not like, nah, go away, it'll never work. He's non-committal, sort of. And so they end up meeting these brothers, these monks of like silence. They don't really talk that much. And a lot of weird goings on start to happen. And they learn this story about this like monk who fell from grace amongst their number, who had coveted somebody's wife. And there are like these weird like possession type things, like a bat on the wall and shadow and you can't touch it. And so they find these mummified monks in the basement. And it turns out like in the morning when they make it through this ordeal that there are no monks. There's no brotherhood. They haven't been there in like 150 years or whatever it is. And so it's, again, it's a haunting, but it also might not be a haunting. There's a lot of moving camera work in this. There's a high degree of fluidity. It's a poetic horror film. So it isn't what you would tend to get with American horror films around the same time. They're very sort of theatrical. It's almost like watching a filmed play. But this is more of a filmed horror poem that also still coheres.
And then finally, another film from 1961, and certainly fits in that theme of things that scare us that occur primarily in the mind, and of course based on one of the great examples of that, Henry James' Turn of the Screw, the 1961 movie The Innocents.
Sure, it's like pretty early on in the film when she, Deborah Carr, she takes this nanny gig, essentially. And she wants to depart the coach and walk the rest of the way to this old manor house where her two charges live. And she hears a voice. She hears this female voice, broad daylight, beautiful day, summer presumably, calling the name of the girl. And we think, huh, that's what's going on with that. She has the conversation with the little girl and or the nanny who is sort of there before her, Mrs. Gross, and says, like, what was that? Who was calling her? It's like, who was calling her? No, there's no one around. I don't know what you heard, miss. And it's just such like a simple thing. It's like a little off kilter. It could be whatever. It could be a passing neighbor. But we know something is wrong, and we just don't know what it's going to be. And the super sort of like terror images, they involve just like someone standing out in like the reeds in a marsh. And we don't know. It's kind of the point of the film. It's a bit like the Shirley Jackson, The Haunting of Hill House, which became The Haunting in 1963, a couple years after this. We don't know, like in that film, whether Eleanor is actually haunted or she's losing her mind. And we never really know with the Deborah Carr character in this film. Is this all in her sort of like hothouse of a head? Or is she actually working to protect these children from these revenants, these lovers that transgressed who have come back now to take charge of the kids?
And I love, I was reading that she asked the director how to play this part, and he said, play it the way you want, but always remember the ambiguity of the character. And that's what makes it so tense at times, is you just don't know.
She's more florid than she is in her other roles. She reminds me of in this film is Agnes Moorehead. Agnes Moorehead could be quite florid, and depending upon your view on the efficiency of that style, like, for instance, I know someone who thinks that she's comical at points in The Magnificent Ambersons, that she's just going too far with her overwroughtness. And I think Deborah Carr walks along a similar line in this film. I could see Agnes Moorehead playing in that role. And it's a film where it's pared down, which is ironic because, like you said, it's based upon Turn of the Screw by Henry James, Now, this wasn't the overgrown prose that James utilized other places. Like, he's pretty under control. But if you were to look at this novella right now, I'm sure you can just go out there, listeners, and find it on, like, Project Gutenberg. You're going to see a lot of subordinate clauses. It's not going to read like a lot of what you read now, if you do read it all. But to get sort of this pared-down elemental film, and it's a very elemental film, from that novella, from that sort of Jamesian voice, is a tribute, I think, to everyone who worked on this, because it's just a small group of players. The boy, and the boy is so creepy. I mean, he really is. Like, I get the sense that the boy is up to more no good than anyone in the film. He's expelled from school, and you never find out why he was expelled. It's like this verboten subject that no one wants to get out into the open. I find that creepy.
Man, the kids are pretty solid in this, too, and that makes it work.
They are. They're also, though, they're disembodied in a way. You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
I do,
yes. They're not. They're not like, they're at some remove from the living in a certain sense, not in the way that kids are. Now, you could say, again, you can always theorize with a film like this. You can say, okay, well, they only have each other. They don't have any little friends. They don't, like, go to school now that he's expelled and she doesn't go anyway. They have this housekeeper, Mrs. Gross. They have the cook and, like, the cook's husband who just sort of drives the coach around. You could really... It's almost like an old person when they're on their own and they're not engaging with other people, they're not engaging with their own mind, they become removed. So the children are sort of elderly people in a way, but it just gives them this discordant aspect that, like, again, off-kilter, something not quite right. Even when they don't do anything wrong or say technically the wrong thing, if you were to quote it to somebody, you know it's wrong. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's like, all right, there's something off with this girl. It's not just like she speaks in this different kind of manner. Something's happened here. And then that just builds with the Deborah Carr character, where she becomes this person who, it's almost out of the Salem witch trials in the end. It's like plays off of that idea.
Check out The Innocents, a wonderful film. I wanted to bring this up, too, before we let you go, because you mentioned it on social media the other day, and I wholeheartedly concur. My favorite episode, and I think the best episode of all time of The Twilight Zone, is Walking Distance.
Yeah, we've talked about that episode before, and what I was saying, and that was really my larger point, I was just using this particular example to make it, is that there can be a difference between perfect and best. I think one of the examples I gave you one time was A Hard Day's Night is a perfect album, but it's not the Beatles' best album.
Right.
Sometimes something risks more, and maybe it doesn't hold together with quite the same, like Within You, Without You on Sgt. Pepper might be something like, oh no, that doesn't really register as a piece with everything else. But this is one of those instances where the best episode of The Twilight Zone was also I think it's the one perfect episode. Normally what you get in these episodes, or too often for my taste, it's the twist ending, because once you get the twist ending, that's going to cancel out any sort of like revisits, because everything hangs on the twist. But one thing that I really like about that episode is that you have this crucial exchange between father and son, maybe the most important exchange they'll ever have. And it exists outside of that space-time continuum in this Twilight Zone. And the father is the father one last time. And the son is the son again one last time, but who's going to carry that advice from the father going forward? So they had all those years together. You don't know how the father died, but like you raised this child, all this stuff. And their most crucial moment comes in this interstitial realm. And I like that because it's like you can have a sort of epiphany from someone who's been in your life who might not be alive anymore, because they live in, again, like some sort of interstitial space of your head. That's why I remember when someone I knew, their father had died, I said, the relationship changes, but it doesn't come to an end.
And what makes that scene so great is that the father, although he doesn't understand it, just accepts that reality to have that conversation and to give advice one more time.
And he's not just giving advice to his son one way. He's protecting his son the other way.
Right.
He's protecting his son's youth, because the sun is kind of like split into these two different temporal spaces. So he's doing a solid for the adult sun, and he's protecting the younger sun. And it's elegantly achieved. I mean, it's like with great simple elan. And a lot of the best Twilight Zone episodes were not written by Rod Serling. I feel like that's kind of one of the knocks on him as a writer looking back. But there is not a Twilight Zone episode that's better written than this one. It's like his Strawberry Fields Forever, his Penny Lane, looking back on his own childhood, but not just doing autobiography. He was sourcing something richer from the spaces he previously inhabited.
Absolutely. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. The new book in the 33 and a third series, Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Again, check out Portland Monthly for Colin's short story, The Captain's Walk, as well. And we'll do it again next Tuesday, whether Hermie's ready for it or not.
All right. I'll see you later, Maine Kimball.
You got it. Colin Fleming on Downtown.